Tell No One, Disc 9.
Chapter 42. Brutus drove like a madman. He took one-way streets in the wrong direction. He made sudden U-turns. From the right lane, he'd cut across traffic and make a left through a red light. We were making excellent time. The Metro Park in Iselin had a train heading toward Port Jervis that left in 20 minutes. I could rent a car from there. When they dropped me off, Brutus stayed in the car. Tyrese walked me to the ticket counter. "You told me to run away and not come back," Tyrese said. "That's right." "Maybe," he said. "You should do the same." I put my hand out for him to shake. Tyrese ignored it and hugged me fiercely. "Thank you," I said softly. He released his grip, adjusted his shoulders so that his jacket relaxed down, fixed his sunglasses. "Yeah, whatever." He didn't wait for me to say anything more before heading back to the car. The train arrived and departed on schedule. I found a seat and collapsed into it. I tried to make my mind go blank. It wouldn't happen. I glanced around. The car was fairly empty. Two college girls with bulky backpacks jabbered in the language of "like" and "you know." My eyes drifted off. I spotted a newspaper. More specifically, a city tabloid that someone had left on a seat. I moved over and picked it up. The coveted cover featured a young starlet who had been arrested for shoplifting. I flipped pages, hoping to read the comics or catch up on sports. Anything mindless would do. But my eyes got snagged on a picture of, well, me. The wanted man. Amazing how sinister I looked in the darkened photo, like a Mideast terrorist. That was when I saw it. And my world, already off kilter, lurched again. I wasn't actually reading the article. My eyes were just wandering down the page. But I saw the names, for the first time. The names of the men who'd been found dead at the lake. One was familiar. Melvin Bartola. It couldn't be. I dropped the paper and ran, opening those sliding doors until I found a conductor two cars away. "Where's the next stop?" I asked him. "Ridgemont, New Jersey." "Is there a library near the station?" "I wouldn't know." I got off there anyway. Eric Wu flexed his fingers. With a small, tight push, he forced the door. It hadn't taken him long to track down the two black men who had helped Dr. Beck escape. Larry Gandel had friends in the police department. Wu had described the men to them, and then he went through the proper mug books. Several hours later, Wu spotted the image of a thug named Brutus Cornwall. They made a few calls and learned that Brutus worked for a drug dealer named Tyrese Barton. Simple. The chain lock snapped. The door flew open, the knob banging against the wall. Letitia looked up, startled. She was about to scream, but Wu moved fast. He clamped his hand over her mouth and lowered his lips to her ear. Another man, someone Gandel had hired, came in behind him. "Shh," Wu said almost gently. On the floor, TJ played with his Hot Wheels. He tilted his head at the noise and said, "Mama?" Eric Wu smiled down at him. He let Letitia go and knelt to the floor. Letitia tried to stop him, but the other man held her back. Wu rested his enormous hand on the boy's head. He stroked TJ's hair as he turned to Letitia.
"Do you know where I can find Tyrese?" he asked her.
Once off the train, I took a taxi to the rent-a-car place. The green-jacketed agent behind the counter gave me directions to the library. It took maybe 3 minutes to get there. The Ridgemont Library was a modern facility, nouveau colonial brick, picture windows, beechwood shelves, balconies, turrets, coffee bar. At the reference desk on the second floor, I found a librarian and asked if I could use the Internet.
"Do you have ID?"
she asked. I did. She looked at it.
You have to be a county resident.
Please, I said. It's very important.
I expected to see a no yield, but she softened.
How long do you think you'll be?
No more than a few minutes.
That computer over there.
She pointed to a terminal behind me.
It's our express terminal. Anyone can use it for 10 minutes.
I thanked her and hurried over. Yahoo found me the site for the New Jersey Journal, the major newspaper of Bergen and Passaic counties. I knew the exact date I needed. 12 years ago on January 12th. I found the search archive and typed in the information. The website went back only 6 years. Damn.
I hurried back to the librarian. I need to find a 12-year article from the New Jersey Journal, I said. It wasn't in their web archive?
I shook my head.
Microfiche, she said, slapping the sides of her chair to rise. What month?
January.
She was a large woman, and her walk was labored. She found the roll in a file drawer and then helped me thread the tape through the machine. I sat back. Good luck, she said.
I fiddled with the knob as if it were a throttle on a new motorcycle. The microfiche shrieked through the mechanism. I stopped every few seconds to see where I was. It took me less than 2 minutes to find the right date. The article was on page 3. As soon as I saw the headline, I felt the lump in my throat. Sometimes I swear that I actually heard the screech of tires, though I was asleep in my bed many miles away from where it happened. It still hurt. Maybe not as much as the night I lost Elizabeth, but this was my first experience with mortality and tragedy, and you never really get over that. 12 years later, I still remember every detail of that night, though it comes back to me in a tornado blur. The pre-dawn doorbell, the solemn-faced police officers at the door, Hoyt standing with them, their soft, careful words, our denials, the slow realization, Linda's drawn face, my own steady tears, my mother still not accepting, hushing me, telling me to stop crying, her already frayed sanity giving way, her telling me to stop acting like a baby, insisting that everything was fine, then suddenly coming close to me, marveling at how big my tears were. Too big, she said. Tears that big belonged on the face of a child, not a grown-up. Touching one, rubbing it between her forefinger and her thumb. Stop crying, David. Growing angrier because I couldn't stop. Her screams then, screaming at me to stop crying, until Linda and Hoyt stepped in and shushed her and someone gave her a sedative, not for the first or last time. It all came back to me in an awful gush. And then I read the article and felt the impact jar me in a whole new direction. Car drives over ravine. One dead, cause unknown. Last night at approximately 3 a.m., a Ford Taurus driven by Stephen Beck of Green River, New Jersey, ran off a bridge in Mahwah, not far from the New York state border. Road conditions were slick due to the snowstorm, but officials have not yet made a ruling on what caused the accident. The sole witness to the accident, Melvin Bartola, a truck driver from Cheyenne, Wyoming. I stopped reading. Suicide or accident? People had wondered which. Now I knew it was neither. Brutus said, "What's wrong?"
"I don't know, man."
Then thinking about it, Tyrese added,
"I don't want to go back."
Brutus didn't reply. Tyrese sneaked a glance at his old friend. They had started hanging out together in third grade. Brutus hadn't been much of a talker back then, either. Probably too busy getting his ass whipped twice a day, home and school, until Brutus figured out the only way he was going to survive was to become the meanest son of a bitch on the block. He started taking a gun to school when he was 11. He killed for the first time when he was 14.
"Ain't you tired of it, Brutus?"
Brutus shrugged.
All we know.
The truth sat there, heavy, unmoving, unblinking. Tyrese's cell phone trilled. He picked it up and said,
Yo? Hello, Tyrese?
Tyrese didn't recognize the strange voice.
Who is it? We met yesterday, in a white van.
His blood turned to ice. Bruce Lee, Tyrese thought. Oh, damn.
What do you want? I have somebody here who wants to say hi.
There was a brief silence, and then TJ said,
Daddy?
Tyrese whipped off his sunglasses. His body went rigid.
TJ? You okay?
But Eric Wu was back on the line.
I'm looking for Dr. Beck, Tyrese. TJ and I were hoping you could help me find him.
I don't know where he is.
Oh, that's a shame.
Swear to God, I don't know.
I see, Wu said.
Then,
hold on a moment, Tyrese, would you? I'd like you to hear something.
Chapter 43. The wind blew, the trees danced, the purple orange of sunset was starting to give way to a polished pewter. It frightened me how much the night air felt exactly the same as it had 8 years ago, the last time I'd ventured near these hallowed grounds. I wondered if Griffin Scope's people would think to keep an eye on Lake Charmaine. It didn't matter, really. Elizabeth was too clever for that. I mentioned earlier that there used to be a summer camp here before Grandpa purchased the property. Elizabeth's clue, Dolphin, was the name of a cabin, the one where the oldest kids had slept, the one deepest in the woods, the one we rarely dared to visit. The rental car climbed what had once been the camp service entrance, though it barely existed anymore. From the main road, you couldn't make it out, the high grass hiding it like the entrance to the Bat Cave. We still kept a chain across it, just in case, with a sign that read, No Trespassing. The chain and sign were both still there, but the years of neglect showed. I stopped the car, unhooked the chain, wrapped it around the tree. I slid back into the driver's seat and headed up to the old camp mess hall. Little of it remained. You could still see the rusted, overturned remnants of what had once been ovens and stoves. Some pots and pans littered the ground, but most had been buried over the years. I got out and smelled the sweet of the green. I tried not to think about my father, but in the clearing, when I was able to look down at the lake, at the way the moon's silver sparkled on the crisp surface, I heard the old ghost again, and wondered this time if it wasn't crying out for revenge. I hiked up the path, though that, too, was pretty much non-existent. Odd that Elizabeth would pick here to meet. I mentioned before that she never liked to play in the ruins of the old summer camp. Linda and I, on the other hand, would marvel when we stumbled over sleeping bags or freshly emptied tin cans, wondering what sort of drifter had left them behind, and if, maybe, the drifter was still nearby. Elizabeth, far smarter than either of us, didn't care for that game. Strange places and uncertainty scared her. It took 10 minutes to get there. The cabin was in remarkably good shape. The ceiling and walls were all still standing, though the wooden steps leading to the door were little more than splinters. The dolphin sign was still there, hanging vertically on one nail. Vines and moss and a melange of vegetation I couldn't name hadn't been dissuaded by the structure. They burrowed in, surrounded it, slithered through holes and windows, consumed the cabin so that it now looked like a natural part of the landscape.
You're back,
a voice said, startling me. A male voice. I reacted without thought. I jumped to the side, fell on the ground, rolled, pulled out the Glock, and took aim. The man merely put his hands up in the air. I looked at him, keeping the Glock on him. He wasn't what I expected. His thick beard looked like a robin's nest after a crow attack. His hair was long and matted. His clothes were tattered camouflage. For a moment, I thought I was back in the city, faced with another homeless panhandler. But the bearings weren't right. The man stood straight and steady. He looked me dead in the eye.
"Who the hell are you?"
I said.
"It's been a long time, David."
"I don't know you."
"No, really, no. But I know you."
He gestured with his head toward the bunk behind me.
"You and your sister. I used to watch you play up here."
"I don't understand." He smiled. His teeth, all there, were blindingly white against the beard.
"I'm the boogeyman."
In the distance, I heard a family of geese squawk as they glided to a landing on the lake's surface. "What do you want?" I asked.
"Not a damn thing," he said, still smiling. "Can I put my hands down?"
I nodded. He dropped his hands. I lowered my weapon but kept it at the ready. I thought about what he'd said and asked, "How long have you been hiding up here?"
"On and off for..."
He seemed to be doing some kind of calculation with his fingers.
30 years.
He grinned at the dumbstruck expression on my face.
"Yeah, I've watched you since you were this high."
He put his hand at knee level.
"Saw you grow up and..."
He paused.
"Been a long time since you've been up here, David."
"Who are you?"
"My name is Jeremiah Renway," he said.
I couldn't place the name.
"I've been hiding from the law."
"So why are you showing yourself now?" He shrugged.
"Guess I'm glad to see you."
"How do you know I won't tell the authorities on you?"
"I figure you owe me one."
"How's that?"
"I saved your life."
I felt the ground beneath me shift.
"What?
Who do you think pulled you out of the water?" he asked.
I was dumbstruck.
"Who do you think dragged you into the house? Who do you think called the ambulance?"
My mouth opened, but no words came out.
"And..."
His smile spread.
"Who do you think dug up those bodies so someone would find them?"
It took me a while to find my voice.
"Why?"
I managed to ask.
"Can't say for sure," he said. "See, I did something bad a long time ago. Guess I thought this was a chance at redemption or something."
"You mean you saw..."
"Everything,"
Renway finished for me.
"I saw them grab your missus. I saw them hit you with a bat. I saw them promise to pull you out if she told them where something was. I saw your missus hand them a key. I saw them laugh and force her into the car while you stayed underwater."
I swallowed. "Did you see them get shot?" Renway smiled again.
"We've chatted long enough, son. She's waiting for you now."
"I don't understand."
"She's waiting for you,"
he repeated, turning away from me.
"By the tree."
Without warning, he sprinted into the woods, darting through the brush like a deer. I stood there and watched him vanish in the thicket. The tree. I ran then. Branches whipped my face. I didn't care. My legs begged me to let up. I paid them no heed. My lungs protested. I told them to toughen up. When I finally made the right at the semi-phallic rock and rounded the pass corner, the tree was still there. I moved closer and felt my eyes start to well up. Our carved initials, EP plus DB, had darkened with age. So too had the 13 lines we had carved out. I stared for a moment, and then I reached out and tentatively touched the grooves. Not of the initials, not of the 13 lines. My fingers traced down the 8 fresh lines, still white and still sticky from sap. Then I heard her say, "I know you think it's goofy." My heart exploded. I turned behind me, and there she was. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. I just stared at her face, that beautiful face, and those eyes. I felt as though I were falling, plummeting down a dark shaft. Her face was thinner, her Yankee cheekbones more pronounced, and I don't think I'd ever seen anything so perfect in all my life. I reminded myself of the teasing dreams then, the nocturnal moments of escape when I would hold her in my arms and stroke her face, and all the while feel myself being pulled away, knowing even as I had been bathing in the bliss that it wasn't real, that soon I'd be flung back into the waking world. The fear that this might be more of the same engulfed me, crushing the wind out of my lungs. Elizabeth seemed to read what I was thinking and nodded as if to say, "Yeah, this is real." She took a tentative step toward me. I could barely breathe, but I managed to shake my head and point at the carved lines and say, "I think it's romantic." She muffled a sob with her hand and sprinted toward me. I opened my arms and she jumped in. I held her. I held her as tight as I could, my eyes squeezed shut. I smelled the lilac and cinnamon in her hair. She buried her face into my chest and sobbed. We gripped and regripped. She still fit. The contours, the grooves of our bodies needed no adjusting. I cupped the back of her head. Her hair was shorter, but the texture hadn't changed. I could feel her shaking, and I'm sure she could feel the same emanating from me. Our first kiss was exquisite and familiar and frighteningly desperate. Two people who had finally reached the surface after misjudging the depth of the water. The years began to melt away, winter giving way to spring. So many emotions ricocheted through me. I didn't sort through them or try to figure them out. I just let it all happen. She lifted her head and looked into my eyes, and I couldn't move. "I'm sorry," she said. And I thought my heart would shatter all over again. I held her. I held her, and I wondered if I would ever risk letting her go. "Just don't leave me again," I said. "Never." "Promise?" "Promise," she said. We kept the embrace. I pressed against the wonder of her skin. I touched the muscles in her back. I kissed the swan neck. I even looked up to the heavens as I just held on. "How?" I wondered. How could this not be another cruel joke? How could she still be alive and back with me? I didn't care. I just wanted it to be real. I wanted it to last. But even as I held her against me, the sound of the cell phone, like something from my teasing dreams, started pulling me away. For a moment, I debated not answering it. But with all that had happened, that wasn't really an option. Loved ones had been left lying in our wake. We couldn't just abandon them. We both knew that. Still keeping one arm around Elizabeth, I'd be damned if I was ever going to let her go. I put the phone to my ear and said hello. It was Tyrese. And as he spoke, I could feel it all start to slip away. Chapter 44. We parked in the abandoned lot at Riker Hill Elementary School and cut across the grounds holding hands. Even in the dark, I could see that very little had changed from the days when Elizabeth and I had frolicked here. The pediatrician in me couldn't help but notice the new safety features. The swing set had stronger chains and harness seats now. Soft mulch was spread thickly under the jungle gyms in case a kid fell. But the kickball field, the soccer field, the blacktop with its painted-on hopscotch and four-square courts, They were all the same as when we were kids. We walked past the window of Miss Sobel's second-grade class, but it was so long ago now that I think neither of us felt more than a ripple of nostalgia. We ducked into the woods, still hand in hand. Neither one of us had taken the path in 20 years, but we still knew the way. 10 minutes later, we were in Elizabeth's backyard on Goodhart Road. I turned to her. She stared at her childhood house with moist eyes. "Your mother never knew?" I asked her. She shook her head. She turned to me. I nodded and slowly let go of her hand.
"Are you sure about this?" she asked.
"No choice," I said. I didn't give her a chance to argue. I stepped away and headed for the house. When I reached the sliding glass door, I cut my hands around my eyes and peered in. No sign of Hoyt. I tried the back door. It was unlocked. I turned the knob and went inside. No one was there. I was about to head out when I saw a light snap on in the garage. I went through the kitchen and into the laundry room. I opened the door to the garage slowly. Hoyt Parker sat in the front seat of his Buick Skylark. The engine was off. He had a drink in his hand. When I opened the door, he lifted his gun. Then, seeing me, he lowered it back to his side. I took the 2 steps down to the cement and reached for the passenger door handle. The car was unlocked. I opened the door and slid in next to him.
"What do you want, Beck?"
There was the slur of drink in his speech. I made a production of settling back in the seat. "Tell Griffin Scope to release the boy," I said.
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
he replied without an iota of conviction. "Graft? Payola? On the take?
Choose your own term, Hoyt.
I know the truth now."
"You don't know shit."
"That night at the lake," I said, "when you helped convince Elizabeth not to go to the police."
"We talked about that already."
"But now I'm curious, Hoyt. What were you really afraid of? That they'd kill her or that you'd be arrested too?" His eyes lazily drifted toward me.
"She'd be dead if I hadn't convinced her to run."
"I don't doubt that," I said. "But still, it was lucky for you, Hoyt. Shooting down 2 birds with 1 stone like that. You were able to save her life, and you were able to stay out of jail."
"And why exactly would I go to jail?"
"Are you denying you were on Scope's payroll?" He shrugged.
"You think I'm the only one who took their money?"
"No," I said.
"So why would I be more worried than the next cop?"
"Because of what you'd done." He finished his drink, looked around for the bottle, poured himself some more.
"I don't know what the hell you're talking about."
"Do you know what Elizabeth was investigating?"
"Brandon Scope's illegal activities," he said. "Prostitution, underage girls, drugs. The guy was playing at being Mr. Bad."
"What else?" I said, trying to stop quivering.
"What are you talking about?"
"If she kept digging, she might have stumbled across a bigger crime." I took a deep breath. "Am I right, Hoyt?" His face sagged when I said that. He turned and stared straight out the front windshield. "A murder," I said. I tried to follow his gaze, but all I saw were Sears Craftsman tools hanging neatly on a pegboard. The screwdrivers with their yellow and black handles were lined up in perfect size order. Flat tops on the left, Phillips head on the right. 3 wrenches and a hammer separated them. I said, "Elizabeth wasn't the first one who wanted to bring Brandon Scope down." Then I stopped and waited. Waited until he looked at me. It took some time, but eventually he did. And I saw it in his eyes. He didn't blink or try to hide it. I saw it. And he knew that I saw it. "Did you kill my father, Hoyt?" He took a deep swig from the glass, swished it around his mouth, and swallowed hard. Some of the whiskey spilled onto his face. He didn't bother to wipe it away.
"Worse," he said, closing his eyes. "I betrayed him."
The rage boiled up in my chest, but my voice stayed surprisingly even. "Why?"
"Come on, David, you must have figured that out by now."
Another flash of fury shot across me. "My father worked with Brandon Scope," I began.
"More than that," he interjected. "Griffin Scope had your dad mentor him. They worked very closely together."
"Like with Elizabeth?"
"Yes."
"And while working with him, my father discovered what a monster Brandon really was, am I right?" Hoyt just drank. "He didn't know what to do," I continued. "He was afraid to tell, but he couldn't just let it go. The guilt ate at him. That was why he was so quiet the months before his death." I stopped and thought about my father, scared, alone, nowhere to turn. Why hadn't I seen it? Why hadn't I looked past my own world and seen his pain? Why hadn't I reached out to him? Why hadn't I done something to help him? I looked at Hoyt. I had a gun in my pocket. How simple it would be. Just take out the gun and pull the trigger. Bam. Gone. Except I knew from personal experience that it wouldn't solve a damn thing. Just the opposite, in fact.
"Go on," Hoyt said.
Somewhere along the line, Dad decided to tell a friend, but not just any friend, a cop. A cop who worked in the city where the crimes were being committed. My blood started boiling, threatening again to erupt. "You, Hoyt." Something in his face shifted. "I got it right so far?"
"Pretty much," he replied.
"You told the Scopes, didn't you?" He nodded.
"I thought they'd transfer him or something, keep him away from Brandon. I never thought..."
He made a face, clearly hating the self-justification in his own voice.
"How'd you know?"
"The name Melvin Bartola, for starters. He was the witness to the supposed accident that killed my father, but of course he worked for Scope, too." My father's smile flashed in front of me. I tightened my hands into fists. "And then there was the lie you told about saving my life," I continued. "You did go back to the lake after you shot Bartola and Wolf, but not to save me. You looked, you saw no movement, and you figured I was dead."
"Figured you were dead," he repeated. "Not wanted you dead."
"Semantics," I said.
"I never wanted you to get hurt."
"But you weren't very broken up about it either," I said. "You went back to the car and told Elizabeth that I had drowned."
"I was just trying to convince her to disappear," he said. "It helped, too."
"You must have been surprised when you heard I was still alive."
"More like shocked. How'd you survive, anyway?"
"It's not important." Hoyt settled back as though from exhaustion.
"Guess not," he said.
His expression veered again, and I was surprised when he said,
"So what else do you want to know?"
"You're not denying any of this?"
"Nope."
"And you knew Melvin Bartola, right?"
"That's right."
"Bartola tipped you off about the hit on Elizabeth," I said. "I can't figure out what happened exactly. Maybe he had a conscience. Maybe he didn't want her to die."
"Bartola, a conscience?" he chuckled. "Please, he was a low-life murdering scum. He came to me because he thought he could double-dip, collect from the Scopes and from me. I told him I'd double his money and help him out of the country if he helped me fake her death."
I nodded, seeing it now. "So Bartola and Wolf told Scope's people that they were gonna lie low after the killing. I wonder why their disappearance didn't raise more eyebrows, but thanks to you, Bartola and Wolf were supposed to go away."
"Yes."
"So what happened? Did you double-cross them?"
"Men like Bartola and Wolf... their word means nothing. No matter how much I paid them, I knew that they'd come back for more. They'd get bored living out of the country, or maybe they'd get drunk and boast about it in a bar. I've dealt with this type of garbage my whole life. I couldn't risk that.
So you killed them?
Yep, he said without an ounce of regret.
I knew it all now. I just didn't know how it was all going to play out.
They're holding a little boy, I said to him. I promised I'd turn myself in if they let him go. You call them. You help make the trade. They don't trust me anymore.
You've worked for Scope for a long time, I said. Come up with something. Hoyt sat there and thought about it. He looked at his tool wall again, and I wondered what he was seeing. Then slowly he lifted the gun and pointed it at my face.
I think I got an idea, he said.
I didn't blink. Open the garage door, Hoyt. He didn't move. I reached across him to the visor and pressed the garage's remote. The door came to life with a whirr. Hoyt watched it rise. Elizabeth stood there, not moving. When it was open all the way, her gaze settled hard on her father's. He flinched.
Hoyt,
I said. His head snapped toward me. With one hand, he grabbed my hair. He pressed the gun against my eye.
Tell her to move out of the way.
I stayed still.
Do it, or you die.
He wouldn't, not in front of her. He leaned closer to me.
Just do it, damn it.
His voice was more like an urgent plea than a hostile command. I looked at him and felt something strange course through me. Hoyt turned on the ignition. I faced the front and gestured for her to move out of the way. She hesitated, but eventually she stepped to the side. Hoyt waited until she was clear of his path. Then he hit the gas. We flew past her with a jerk. As we hurtled away, I turned and watched out the back window as Elizabeth grew dimmer, fainter, until finally she was gone. Again. I sat back and wondered if I would ever see her again. I had feigned confidence before, but I knew the odds. She fought me on it. I explained that I had to do this. I needed to be the one doing the protecting this time. Elizabeth hadn't liked it, but she understood. In the past few days, I'd learned that she was alive. Would I trade my life for that? Gladly. I understood that going in. A strange, peaceful feeling came over me as I drove with the man who betrayed my father. The guilt that had weighed me down for so long finally lifted its hold. I knew now what I had to do, what I had to sacrifice. And I wondered if there was ever any choice, if it had been preordained to end like this. I turned to Hoyt and said,
Elizabeth didn't kill Brandon Scope. I know, he interrupted.
And then he said something that shook me to the core.
I did.
I froze.
Brandon beat up Elizabeth, he went on quickly. He was going to kill her. So I shot him when he got to the house. Then I framed Gonzalez, just like I said before. Elizabeth knew what I had done. She wouldn't let an innocent man take the fall. So she made up that alibi. Scope's people heard about it, and it made them wonder. When they then began to suspect that maybe Elizabeth was the killer,
he stopped, kept his eyes on the road, summoned something from deep inside.
God help me, I let them.
I handed him the cell phone. Call, I said. He did. He called a man named Larry Gandel. I had met Gandel several times over the years. His father had gone to high school with mine.
I have Beck, Hoyt told him. We'll meet you at the stables, but you have to release the kid.
Larry Gandel said something I couldn't make out.
As soon as we know the kid is safe, we'll be there, I heard Hoyt say. And tell Griffin I have what he wants. We can end this without hurting me or my family.
Gandol spoke again, and then I heard him click off the line. Hoyt handed me back the phone. Am I a part of your family, Hoyt? He aimed the gun at my head again.
Slowly take out your Glock, Beck. Two fingers.
I did as he asked. He hit the electric window slide.
Toss it out the window.
I hesitated. He pushed the muzzle into my eye. I flipped the gun out of the car. I never heard it land. We drove in silence now, waiting for the phone to ring again. When it did, I was the one who answered it. Tyrese said in a soft voice,
"He's okay."
I hung up relieved. "Where are you taking me, Hoyt?"
"You know where.
Griffin's scope will kill us both."
"Nah," he said, still pointing the gun at me. "Not both."
Chapter 45. We turned off the highway and headed into the rural. The number of streetlights dwindled until the only illumination came from the car's headlights. Hoyt reached into the back seat and pulled out a manila envelope.
"I have it here, Beck, all of it."
"All of what?"
"What your father had on Brandon. What Elizabeth had on Brandon."
I was puzzled for a second. He'd had it with him the whole time. And then I wondered, the car. Why had Hoyt gone to the car? "Where are the copies?" I asked. He grinned as though happy I had asked.
"There aren't any. It's all here."
"I still don't understand."
"You will, David. I'm sorry, but you're my fall guy now. It's the only way."
"Scope won't buy it," I said.
"Yeah, he will. Like you said, I've worked for him a long time. I know what he wants to hear. Tonight it ends."
"With my death?" I asked. He didn't reply. "How are you going to explain it to Elizabeth?"
"She might end up hating me," he said. "But at least she'll be alive."
Up ahead, I could see the estate's gated back entrance. Endgame, I thought. The uniformed security guard waved us through. Hoyt kept the gun on me. He started up the drive, and then, without warning, Hoyt slammed on the brake. He spun toward me.
"You wearing a wire, Beck?"
"What? No."
"Bullshit. Let me see."
He reached for my chest. I leaned away. He lifted the gun higher, closed the gap between us, and then started patting me down. Satisfied, he sat back.
"You're lucky,"
he said with a sneer. He shifted back into drive. Even in the dark, you could get a feel for the lushness of the grounds. Trees stood silhouetted against the moon, swaying even though there seemed to be no wind. In the distance, I saw a burst of lights. Hoyt followed the road toward them. A faded gray sign told us we'd arrived at the Freedom Trail Stables. We parked in the first spot on the left. I looked out the window. I don't know much about the housing of horses, but this sprawl was impressive. There was one hangar-shaped building large enough to house a dozen tennis courts. The stables themselves were V-shaped and stretched as far as I could see. There was a sprouting fountain in the middle of the grounds. There were tracks and jumps and obstacle courses. There were also men waiting for us. With the weapon still on me, Hoyt said,
"Get out."
I did. When I closed the door, the slam echoed in the stillness. Hoyt came around to my side of the car and jammed the gun into the small of my back. The smells brought on a quick spell of 4-H fair deja vu. But when I saw the four men in front of me, two of whom I recognized, the image fled. The other two, the two I'd never seen before, were both armed with some sort of semi-automatic rifle. They pointed them at us. I barely shuddered.
I guess that I was getting used to weapons aimed in my direction. One of the men stood on the far right near the stable entrance. The other was leaning against a car on the left. The two men I had recognized were huddled together under a light. One was Larry Gandel. The other was Griffin Scope. Hoyt nudged me forward with the gun. As we moved toward them, I saw the door to the big building open. Eric Wu stepped out. My heart thumped against my ribcage. I could hear my breath in my ears. My legs tingled. I might be immune to weapon intimidation, but my body remembered Wu's fingers. I involuntarily slowed a step. Wu hardly glanced at me. He walked straight to Griffin's Scope and handed him something. Hoyt made me stop when we were still a dozen yards away.
"Good news," he called out.
All eyes turned to Griffin's Scope. I knew the man, of course. I was, after all, the son of an old friend and the brother of a trusted employee. Like most everyone else, I'd been in awe of the burly man with a twinkle in his eye. He was the guy you wanted to notice you. A back-slap, buy-you-a-drink compadre who had the rare ability to walk the tightrope between friend and employer. It was a mix that rarely worked. The boss either lost respect when he became a friend, or the friend was resented when he suddenly had to be the boss. That wasn't a problem for a dynamo like Griffin Scope. He'd always known how to lead. Griffin Scope looked puzzled.
"Good news, Hoyt?"
Hoyt tried to smile.
"Very good news, I think."
"Wonderful," Scope said.
He glanced at Wu. Wu nodded but stayed where he was. Scope said,
"So tell me this good news, Hoyt. I'm all a twitter."
Hoyt cleared his throat.
"First of all, you have to understand, I never meant to harm you. In fact, I went to great lengths to make sure nothing incriminating ever got out. But I also needed to save my daughter. You can understand that, can't you?"
A shadow flickered across Scope's face.
"Do I understand the desire to protect a child?" he asked, his voice a quiet rumble. "Yes, Hoyt, I think I do."
A horse neighed in the distance. All else was silence. Hoyt licked his lips and held up the manila envelope.
"What's that, Hoyt?"
"Everything," he replied. "Photographs, statements, tapes. Everything that my daughter and Stephen Beck had on your son."
"Are there copies?"
"Only one," Hoyt said.
"Where?"
"In a safe place. An attorney has it. If I don't call him in an hour and give him the code, he releases them. I don't mean this as a threat, Mr. Scope. I would never reveal what I know. I have as much to lose as anyone."
"Yes," Scope said. "You do at that. But now you can leave us alone. You have it all. I'll send the rest. There's no need to hurt me or my family."
Griffin Scope looked at Larry Gandel, then at Eric Wu. The two perimeter men with the weapons seemed tense.
"What about my son, Hoyt? Someone shot him down like a dog. Do you expect me to just let that go?"
"That's just it," Hoyt said. "Elizabeth didn't do it."
Scope narrowed his eyes in what was supposed to be profound interest, but I thought I saw something else there, something akin to bemusement.
"Pray tell," he said. "Then who did?"
I heard Hoyt swallow hard. He turned and looked at me.
"David Beck."
I wasn't surprised. I wasn't angry, either.
"He killed your son," he continued quickly. "He found out what was going on, and he took vengeance."
Scope made a production of gasping and putting his hand on his chest. Then he finally looked at me. Wu and Gandel turned my way, too. Scope met my eyes and said,
"What do you have to say in your defense, Dr. Beck?"
I thought about it. "Would it do any good to tell you he's lying?" Scope didn't reply to me directly. He turned to Wu and said,
"Please bring me that envelope."
Wu had the walk of a panther. He headed toward us, smiling at me, and I felt a few of my muscles contract instinctively. He stopped in front of Hoyt and put out his hand. Hoyt handed him the envelope. Wu took the envelope with one hand. With the other, I've never seen anyone move so fast. He snatched away Hoyt's gun as though from a child and tossed it behind him. Hoyt said,
"What the?"
Wu punched him deep in the solar plexus. Hoyt fell to his knees. We all stood and watched as he dropped to all fours, retching. Wu circled, took his time, and placed his kick squarely on Hoyt's ribcage. I heard something snap. Hoyt rolled onto his back, blinking. His arms and legs splayed. Griffin Scope approached, smiling down at my father-in-law. Then he held up something in the air. I squinted. It was small and black. Hoyt looked up, spitting out blood.
"I don't understand," he managed.
I could see what was in Scope's hand now. It was a micro cassette player. Scope pressed the play button. I heard first my own voice, then Hoyt's. "Elizabeth didn't kill Brandon Scope."
"I know. I did."
Scope snapped off the tape recorder. Nobody spoke. Scope glared down at my father-in-law. As he did, I realized a number of things. I realized that if Hoyt Parker knew that his house was bugged, he'd also know that it was more than likely that the same would be true of his car. That was why he left the house when he spotted us in the backyard. That was why he waited for me in the car. That was why he interrupted me when I said that Elizabeth didn't kill Brandon Scope. That was why he confessed to the murder in a place where he knew they'd be listening. I realized that when he patted me down, he did indeed feel the wire that Carlson had put on my chest, that he wanted to make sure that the feds, too, would hear everything, and that Scope wouldn't bother frisking me. I realized that Hoyt Parker was taking the fall, that while he had done many terrible things, including betraying my father, this had all been a ruse, a last chance at redemption, that in the end he, not I, would sacrifice himself to save us all. I also realized that for his plan to work, he had to do one more thing. So I stepped away. And even as I heard the FBI helicopter start to descend, even as I heard Carlson's voice through a megaphone shout for everyone to freeze, I watched Hoyt Parker reach into his ankle holster, pull out a gun, and fire it three times at Griffin Scope. Then I watched him turn the gun around. I shouted, "No," but the final blast smothered it out. Chapter 46. We buried Hoyt 4 days later. Thousands of uniformed cops showed up to pay their respects. The details of what had happened at the Scope estate weren't out yet, and I wasn't sure they ever would be. Even Elizabeth's mother hadn't pushed for answers, but perhaps that had more to do with the fact that she was delirious with joy over her daughter's return from the dead. I made her not want to ask too many questions or look at the cracks too closely. I could relate. For now, Hoyt Parker had died a hero, and maybe that was true. I'm not the best judge. Hoyt had written a long confession, basically restating what he had told me in the car. Carlson showed it to me.
"Does this end it?" I asked.
"We still have to make a case against Gandel and Wu and some of the others," he said. "But with Griffin Scope dead, everyone's cutting deals now." The mythical beast, I thought. You don't chop off its head. You stab it in the heart.
"You were smart to come to me when they kidnapped that little boy," Carlson said to me.
"What was my alternative?"
"Good point." Carlson shook my hand. "Take care of yourself, Dr. Beck."
"You too," I said. You may want to know if Tyrese ever goes down to Florida and what happens to TJ and Letitia. You may be wondering if Shauna and Linda stay together and what that means to Mark, but I can't tell any of that because I don't know. This story ends now, 4 days after the death of Hoyt Parker and Griffin Scope. It's late, very late. I'm lying in bed with Elizabeth, watching her body rise and fall in sleep. I watch her all the time. I don't close my eyes much. My dreams have perversely reversed themselves. It's in my dreams now that I lose her, where she's dead again, and I'm alone. So I hold her a lot. I'm clingy and needy. So is she. But we'll work that out. As though she feels my eyes on her, Elizabeth rolls over. I smile at her. She smiles back, and I feel my heart soar. I remember the day at the lake. I remember drifting on that raft. And I remember my decision to tell her the truth. "We need to talk," I say.
"I don't think so."
"We're not good at keeping secrets from each other, Elizabeth. It's what caused this mess in the first place. If we just told each other everything..." I didn't finish. She nods, and I realize that she knows, that she's always known. "Your father," I say, "he always thought you killed Brandon Scope." "That's what I told him. But in the end..." I stop, start again. "When I said in the car that you didn't kill him, do you think he realized the truth?"
"I don't know," Elizabeth says. "I like to think that maybe he did."
"So he sacrificed himself for us?"
"Or he tried to stop you from doing it," she says. "Or maybe he died still thinking I killed Brandon Scope. We'll never really know. And it doesn't matter."
We look at each other.
"You knew,"
I say, my chest hitching.
"From the beginning, you..."
She hushes me with a finger on my lips.
"It's okay."
"You put all that stuff in the safety deposit box," I say.
"For me." "I wanted to protect you," she says.
"It was in self-defense," I say, again remembering the feel of the gun in my hand, the sickening backfire when I pulled the trigger.
"I know,"
she says, wrapping her arms around my neck and pulling me close.
"I know."
"You see, I was the one who was home when Brandon Scope broke into our house 8 years ago. I was the one lying alone in the bed when he sneaked up with a knife. We struggled. I fumbled for my father's gun. He lunged again. I shot and killed him. And then in a panic, I ran. I tried to gather my thoughts, figure out what to do. When I came to my senses, when I returned to the house, the body was gone. So was the gun. I wanted to tell her. I was going to at the lake. But in the end, I never said anything about it. Until now. Like I told you earlier, if I had just told the truth from the get-go..." She pulls me closer.
"I'm here,"
Elizabeth whispers. "Here. With me." It would take a while to accept that, but I would. We hold each other and drift off to sleep. Tomorrow morning we would wake up together. And the morning after that, too. Her face would be the first I'd see every day. Her voice would be the first I'd hear. And that, I knew, would always be enough.
The End. You've been listening to Tell No One by Harlan Coben, narrated by Ed Sala. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Dead Eyes by Stuart Woods, narrated by Richard Ferrone, and The List by Steve Martini, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.